Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Hey guys, welcome back to Magic TV. My name's Craig. It is 9 o'clock and it's time for a Talk Magic. And here, right now, on this channel, I have an absolute legend of the magic community that's been interviewed. Somebody I have been a big fan of for years, gold star member of the Magic Circle, had one of the most successful careers in magic. The man behind the Sooty Show, as well as being an incredibly successful performer, illusionist. He's currently going on tour with a big touring show. Then he's got Panto. There's so much going on. It makes me tired just thinking about it. I don't use the word legend lightly. He really is the one and only Richard Cadell. How are you, Richard? Are you okay?
I'm great. Thanks. Thank you, Craig, for that ridiculous introduction. Bless you for saying that. What a kind thing. How can I answer that? It's very kind of you. I've been very lucky. I've been able to sort of coast through life doing what I love. And magic's been there from when I was a little tiny kid. So I've just been able to carve a living doing my childhood passion, really. I mean, that's it, you know.
You know, there's a lot of magicians worldwide that are successful and they have a successful career, but there's very few magicians that make the impact, that have the impact on not just the community, but like literally everybody that you've had. Like, I know from speaking to people, there are so many magicians that are magicians now, professional magicians, because of watching you over the years. Like, seriously, you have created an entire generation of magicians with some of the output that you've you know put out over the years. I mean, seriously, I genuinely. I'm so excited. The camera's dropping. Like, that's how excited I am.
It pops out. Yeah. It was with emotion. There we are with that. I couldn't have timed that better. I don't know what to say to that. No one's ever said that to me. I mean, I suppose I'm 54 now. I remember we were just talking, I was with Russ Steam yesterday, and we were talking about the Blackpool Magic Convention and how important kids are within that. And I said, well, I was 12, I think, when I came to my first Blackpool Magic Convention. And I watched all those people, I suppose, that influenced me, that made me want to do it, you know? And so I never considered anyone to be watching me. Well, listen, I hope, it's wonderful to think that somebody somewhere is got the bug through some of the nonsense I've done, and thank you for saying that. And I'm very humbled.
It's true, but as well as being a magician and a performer, you've also definitely could be classed as an entrepreneur. I mean, you've built a massive brand. I mean, there was already a brand there, but you can't argue that you've taken Sooty to an entirely new level. Which is great, and I really want to kind of dissect some of the things that you've done and some of the decisions you've made. And I obviously want to talk about the tour, because that's a total departure for you with what's coming up soon. I want to talk about that. There's lots to talk about, basically.
Go for it. Let's start
at the very beginning. Just for anybody who's been living under a rock and they're watching this and they go, who's this Richard Cadell guy? Let's start at the very beginning, and let's just very quickly touch on the origin story. You mentioned there that you were 12 years old when you got into magic.
I was younger.
How did you get into magic? Where did it all come from?
It sort of happened, a few things sort of all, the stars kind of aligned. I had a magician to my party when I was five, or even probably younger, a guy called Brian Lee. Who became a lifelong friend, and he was a magician in Leicester, and I just knew I kind of wanted to know more about it. He gave me a balloon to put under the pillow and all the jokes and stuff, but I was just mad about it. And then I started getting magic sets, the usual thing. But the big turning point for me was I was doing child acting. And my mother was a professional actress, so she was, I loved it. And she was able to get me into auditions and things. And I was doing some child acting, and there was a guy in the same play with me who was learning his next role after he'd finished the play I was in, was to play the part of a magician. And he was telling me that he was having lessons in magic from someone in the magic circle. And I was only a kid, and my parents were at that time forcing me to have piano lessons. And I hated it. I dreaded it. I hated it. So I went back to my mum and I went, that guy Herbert, he's having magic lessons. I just, the idea of having magic lessons was incredible. I said, can I please swap these horrible piano lessons for the magic lessons? And they agreed. And a member of the Leicester Magic Circle called Brian Glover came to my house and started teaching me magic. And every Friday he would come, and he became, again, a lifelong friend and a mentor, and was with me all the way through, you know, right. Even now, you know, he's still my friend. He's in his 80s. But when I was doing my illusions professionally, when I was, you know, doing all that stuff, he was there in the audience watching. I mean, he was on that journey all the way through. You know, he took me to the Reading Junior Day, which at the time was the only thing for young magicians. And that was an incredible experience. Then I entered the competition, and then I went into the Young Magician of the Year competition. I was 15 when I went into that, and lucky enough to have won it, which was again incredible. And so, yeah, I think it was that combination, that luck of being in that play and having magic lessons by a magician that was a really good teacher and taught me the rudiments. So I kind of had a bit of a head start. Yeah, I was lucky, but I soaked it up and I loved it. You know, I just loved every second of it.
And when you were learning magic, was there an end goal? Because you're a child actor, you're taking magic lessons. Were you thinking, you know what, I think I could make a profession out of doing this? Or was it just a fun thing that you were learning to, you know, just
naturally? There was never any doubt that I'd do it as a living or do performing. My mother was an actress. She'd done it professionally. So my dad was a doctor and wanted me to sort of go to college and university. My mum said, he's never going to do that, Ron, you know, you forget that. So when I left school, and I was a holiday camp entertainer within a few weeks, literally, of leaving school. I was barely 16. And I was a green coat down at Hailing Island doing my little magic shows, my children's shows, Punch and Judy, DJing, Keep Fit. I mean, I did everything in that holiday camp. I loved every second of it. So, no, there was never any doubt that I'd do that, because I just couldn't imagine myself doing anything else, you know. So yeah, I was straight into it. Best experience I ever had in the holiday camp. It was incredible.
Well, I want to talk about that, but before we do, your magic lessons, we don't think of you as a close-up magician. We think of you as a stage performer and illusionist and so on and so forth. Where did you start learning stage magic? Was it right at the very beginning when you had magic lessons, or did you start learning little close-up bits and pieces, and what made you gravitate towards stage?
Right, well, there was a stage, I mean, back in that era, I'm going back into the early 80s, when you went in competition, there were more stage acts. You know, it's not so much now, it's more close-up. But my magic teacher, Brian Glover, was very, he taught me the rudiments. So I could do close-up, I could do coin manipulation, I could do some very basic card manipulation. He said, you need to learn this. And then we did, so I could do a bit of close-up, and then I'd concentrate on stage magic, but it wasn't illusions. If anything, he kind of, I wanted to do the illusions. I remember seeing a Siegfried and Roy special that had found its way onto ITV and going, and my magic Brian saying, look, the trouble with illusions, and he was absolutely right. I mean, I remember him saying, he said, the props, unless you've got a huge personality like Siegfried and Roy, the props are bigger than you are. And you've got to be bigger than the props. Whereas if you've got something small, it can be, and the magic is all about you and it's not about the props. And he was right. But I knew when I saw the illusions, there was something in me that just, I loved that spectacular nonsense of it all. But I think looking back, and this is, I can often tell when I look at illusion acts, the better ones, when they've had a grounding in those rudiments of magic and stuff, it does translate into the boxes, even though a lot of magicians are quick to dismiss boxes and big props as self-working. But actually, you know, having that foundation is very important, having an understanding of all of it, you know. And I was lucky that Brian made sure that I did. It was part of the thing. I remember doing coins across, and actually it was quite difficult for me at the time, and he made me do it, and he made me go to school and try and palm a two-pence piece, which was quite, you know, obviously the change was bigger. He said, you've got to get through the whole of the day without dropping that. You've got to write, you've got to do everything and see if you can get, and I tried it, but you know, I didn't always succeed, but I tried to get through the day without anyone saying, what's that in your hand? It was great fun, you know, so.
That's great. Anyway. That's fantastic. And then obviously you move on to the holiday parks. So you weren't like doing the holiday park circuit as a visiting cabaret act. You were stationed in one holiday park as like a coat entertainer, but you were getting a chance to do your show, which I imagine would give you lots of experience and lots of flight time, which is kind of what you need, right?
Well, it did. And I tell you what happened, actually. I learned a hard lesson then, which I learned when I got into the holiday camp, because I suddenly I was DJing and I was doing all sorts of things because they make you do everything and that's great. And I learned that the magic that I'd learned for the Young Magician of the Year act and stuff like that didn't go very well in front of the holiday camp audience. And we had a visiting act that used to come in every week, which I think was an act called Richard and Lara Charmaine, if I remember correctly, who used to storm the place with a sub trunk and a zigzag and some stuff and an invisible deck and stuff like that. And that's when I realized there was, the penny really dropped. Hang on a minute, if I'm gonna work commercially, I need to tweak what I'm doing. My first holiday season, I hope this isn't boring, by the way, but it's lovely to reminisce. I don't get the chance to reminisce. This is all flooding back. My holiday camp's gone, long gone. It was on Hayling Island, which is down near Portsmouth. And there was an illusion builder on the Isle of Wight called the Magic Box, a guy called Sid Edwards. And that was only a ferry ride away. And he built me a substitution trunk because I'd seen Richard and Lara do this thing. And I thought, I'd like that. I'd love one of those boxes. And it was £300, a great sub trunk. I've still got it. But I was on, I think at the time, something like 80 quid a week as a holiday camp entertainer. And you had to buy your own food. So the lady in the gift shop felt sorry for me. And she used to give me all the popcorn at the end of the day they hadn't sold. So I sort of lived on popcorn and I saved the money to be able to buy this sub trunk. And I remember going over there and Sid Edwards picking me up from the ferry and me having this big prop and just setting it up in my tiny chalet. And I hadn't got anyone to perform it with, but I just remember looking at it like it was the crown jewels, like you're like, you know, this was the best thing I'd ever bought. And the first time I did it, I mean, I think the switch probably took forever. It's probably half an hour. I was shaking the cloth with some other green coat I'd managed to talk into doing it. But I kind of knew then, I thought, this is, you know, the audience loved that. And I thought, hang on a minute, you know, this is, I'd love to do more of this. And then there was a moment as well, a big moment in the holiday camp. A friend of mine that I'd known as a young magician, when we were kicking around Reading Junior Day, he visited the holiday camp as a visiting act. I was just a green coat. And he said, he was doing illusions. And he said, I've bought this illusion of Derek Lever. They said, I bought this illusion. He said, it doesn't work. I can't make it work. It's an impaled illusion. He said, it's all, and I've got a bit of a mechanical sort of brain. I love mechanics and all that stuff. So I said, well, I'll fix it. He said, I'm sick of it. He said, I just want to sell it. And I hadn't got any money at the time. Anyway, he said, well, if you want to buy it, you can owe me the money. So he left me with this impaled illusion. I thought, well, I've got the subtrunk, got this impaled, I'm going to make it work. Now I had an act. Mm. Now I had an act. So that's where it said, okay, here we go. And I went on the impaler and I got it to work. And I think that was the turning point where I thought, okay, I've got two big props now. Now I need a girl assistant and now I'm going to get, anyway, that's when the path turned towards the bigger props. Yeah.
And so how long was it before you left the holiday park? Because I imagine as you put that act together, you kind of got to the point where you're like, okay, I'm kind of being restricted here. I've got a show that's good enough to tour different holiday parks or do something else. What was your next step after putting the act together?
Well, I only did a year at the holiday park because one of the Ents team, it was really good, said to me, don't only do a year, because there's some of those green coats have been there for years and years and years, and they just got trapped in a bubble. And he said, you've got to get out of this otherwise, because I wanted to go back, because you become a little star. By the end of the week, when you do your act, those holiday makers, they love you and know you because you're Richard, the guy that's done the crazy golf and helped the kids. And so they go crazy for you. But in the real world, it was very different because they don't know who you are. So this the advice was to get out there and I found it quite hard. And I'll be honest with you, I died on my arse a lot. I got paid off when I went to Hastings and did a job on the pier with the Magic. I got paid off because I was so bad. Yeah, I mean, for the real people, just because I was, I don't know, I was a bit cheesy. Something just didn't work. It was for a young DJ type club crowd, and I was so off the mark. They just said, "Oh, don't worry about going on again and go home." So, but you have to do that, you know. You mm-hmm. have to die on your arse. You have to know what that feels like to then dissect it, you know, to know what it feels like when you get it right, you know. So it wasn't easy to start with.
And it's true what you say, you know, that I toured the holiday parks for years, and I was a red coat at Butlins. And in order to make it work on the holiday park circuit, you have to develop a certain style that doesn't necessarily translate to a corporate audience or, you know, something else. You try it. I remember the first time I tried to go from holiday parks and I got a gig as a corporate, and I just, same thing, I just died on my ass. I tried to do my holiday park act and it just didn't work at all. So I can absolutely completely relate to that.
It was a long interesting path, a slow path. I think I could go on forever, but go and ask me another question, otherwise I'll get boring and
I'm finding this whole thing fascinating. So you've left, you did a year as a green coat, you've left, you're now trying to make it as an illusionist. I suppose several questions. What was the next kind of big thing?
I'll tell you, because there's a bit of a sad story to it, really. I don't share this with many people, but it's long enough ago. But I said to, you know, like I said, when I left the holiday camp, I got these two props and I died. I was working commercially and I was awful. I wasn't going well. I fell out of love with not with magic, but with my ability. I lost a lot of confidence. I thought, well, this is, you know, Young Magician of the Year and Magicians is great, but I don't know how I'm going to do that. I'm not doing a good job here. I'm not being successful. And this is, you know, I was very disillusioned. I've also got another passion and a love of mine is amusements and fairground equipment. And I've operated in the amusement business as a parallel for a long time. So I actually went after I left the holiday camp, I went to a little village in Bream. And I spent my days running a ghost train, and in the evening I'd go and DJ, and I didn't do any magic for two or three years, really, because I just kind of fell out of love with it. I didn't know how it was going to work. And then I thought, you know what I'll do? I'll DJ one night, I'll do the Impaler, and I'll dress up as Freddy Krueger, and I'll do it as a bit of a horror thing for Halloween. And I did, I dressed up as Freddy Krueger, and I did the Impaler, and it stormed. It went really well, and that's when I thought, okay, I'm back now. I'm okay now. And because I was working with the fun fair and earning a little bit of money, I was able to then invest in some bigger props and get a proper act together. Mm-hmm. And I think the real turning point was I got an agent who said, look, if you're going to do something, you know, if you're really going to crack the summer seasons and get out of the holiday centres and into the theatres, you need a big, big trick. And I think he flippantly says, why don't you vanish a car or something? And I said, well, there's a vanishing motorcycle trick people do. You know, that's it's kind of, you know, been around a while. He went, well, that sounds sensational. So I thought, OK, I'll get the Dizzy Limit vanishing motorcycle. And I was living in a caravan at the time. I hadn't got a penny. I hadn't got anything. Literally living in a caravan. Yeah, with no heating. And also, honestly, but I wanted this bloody Dizzy Limit trick. And I phoned Dave Shaw of Quality Props, bless him, and he thought I was mad, but agreed to build it, and he gave me credit on it. And I got these bikes, and I bought a winch, and I got it together, and I got a summer season on the back of it at the Playhouse Theatre in Weston-super-Mare. And this, I had begged and borrowed every penny to get this thing together, gone without, you know, food, you know, it was ridiculous. And I remember getting it onto the stage, getting a summer season for 200 quid a week, this job was, and I had to pay two girls out of that and a guy as well. So it was ridiculous. There was no money in it because they were taking a chance on me. You know, my agent said, look, he's going to do this thing with a bike. No one had seen it. They didn't know what it was. And I remember rigging it and watching it vanish for the first time. And I cried. I was we had the bike in the air and it all fell apart and the thing disappeared. And I cried, I sobbed. And I thought, oh my God, this, we're onto something. And I did it. And the next summer, the agents came to see it. And then I went, that was it then. I was on the summer, the theatre summer season circuit. That illusion was, that was a game changer, because suddenly, I mean, just to have a bike hanging in the air was dramatic enough, but that's what they all wanted. And I did some great summer seasons when they existed. Torquay, Paignton, Weymouth, Blackpool, you know, Scarborough, you know, all of those big theatres packed out, you know, with the bike trick. So that was the turning point, was that one illusion. Yeah.
I suppose the lesson here is sometimes you need to take a step back to take a step forward. Like, if you hadn't have moved away from magic for a while, do you think you would have achieved the same level of success if you carried on with the same mindset? Or did you think you needed to take that step back in order to kind of find yourself again?
Yeah, I think so. I've always been quite critical of myself, but I've been, I suppose, realistic. I know when I'm not good at something, and I just knew I could crack it somehow. So I held on to that little dream and that belief, and and I was really lucky. I aligned myself to to two people, an assistant and her husband at the time, who were so loyal and dedicated. And we created some really good stuff. I watched last night a thing on YouTube, and if any of you viewers want to Google it, Google Richard Cadell Illusion, and Magic Week put this up a few years ago. It's me in 2000, 23 years ago, on the show called The Big Stage, doing an illusion where it's a clear substitution trunk where the girl disappears and she appears in a tank of water. Right.
Wow.
It's worth watching, only because this tank of water illusion, I built this glass tank, and I'd spent all the money on it, and I was going to do it. I was going to produce the girl like a fire cage works. Now, if any of your viewers don't know what a fire cage is, I'm sure I'm giving too much away to say that you think you're looking at the back of the cage, you're not. All right. So I was going to do something where the girl was hidden at the back of the tank, but you thought you were looking through to the cloth or whatever at the back, but you weren't. Well, when we tried to work, because it worked for the fire cage brilliantly, but when we tried it with the water in it, it didn't work at all. The water changed the perspective, it changed the colour, nothing would move because the water, and it was just a complete disaster. And I remember this girl, this wonderful assistant, Christine, insisting that she would make it work. And we were up all night. We had a summer season booked. I promised them this tank thing, and we were literally going to go the next day. And we were up all night. And she said to me, she went, hang on a minute. She went, I think if I do this, I could get here. And I went, what? She went, no, look, if I do this and do this, and I hang on here, I could hang on. And anyway, and that illusion was born purely out of that girl's dedication to putting herself through anything to make it work. And when I look back, every time I watch that video, I thought, if she hadn't have had the pure commitment and the pain to put herself through that, we'd have never created what I think even now. I actually thought when I watched it last night, I must rebuild that, I must do it again. It's too good just to leave. And anyway, sorry, I'm waffling.
No, you're really not. This is amazing. This is one of my favorite interviews. I'm loving this.
Well, I'll tell you another thing as well. This is a good one, all right? And this is more recent. It just shows you should always, I love listening to people. I listen to any advice, anyone's got any advice, I listen to everything. Because there's always within that, there's always something, you know, there's always something. And I had a lad work on the illusion show, and he's a lad that I have a funfair business as well. And he works on the funfair. And I needed, he was only about 18, 19 at the time. And I needed someone to push and pull a prop. And I'd been doing this one illusion. I'm doing it in Extreme Magic, but I'd been doing it a good few years, and I kind of had it built to it. It was my idea, and I knew everything about it, and blah, blah, blah. And he's just a kid pushing a prop. And he just said to me, casually said, why do you do the switch thing there? Why don't you just do it then instead of all of that? And I went, what? He went, well, just do it then. Why do you do all that bit? Why you just don't do it? I went, hang on a minute. But oh my God, you've completely revolutionized this whole thing. And he did. He cut 30, 40 seconds of ambiguity out of it, and he made it 20 million times more deceptive just because he'd come from it totally outside of it. And then, see, she'd always, and whenever I do that, I think, if it wasn't for Mike, you know, little Mike, I'd, you know, every time I do that little move, I think, wow, you know, fair shout. Anyway, sorry, now I am becoming boring, but I just, yeah. So I've basically nicked everyone's advice along the way, you know, taken everyone's
advice. Best way to be. So you're flying high. You're doing summer seasons. You're traveling the UK. You're doing big illusions. You're making bikes disappear. At some point, we're going to have a little yellow bear involved in this story. Yep. Does that come now, or was there something that happened before that?
I'll tell you what happened. Again, it's tinged with a bit of sadness. I dreamed always of doing the best summer season in the country, which was the Blackpool Grand Theatre. That was the best summer season. It had all the dancers, variety acts and everything. And it was when summer seasons were coming to an end, when all those Torquays and Scarboroughs had disappeared, only Blackpool was remaining with those big variety shows. And I was lucky enough to do that show with all my illusions. The bike trip closed the show because the producer said, it's just, you know, it's the strongest thing in the show. And I said to the stars, don't you mind that it's closing? But no, don't, you know, it's great. It was the finale of the whole thing. Me riding down the audience was fantastic. And I did that season, and they announced at the end of that season that was the end of the summer seasons at the Grand. And my agent at the time said, well, there's no theatres left now, kid. So you probably, you know, you might have to do the holiday centres again. I said, well, how am I going to do my bike and my water tank? And I can't do that on one-nighters. I can't do that. He said, well, you're going to have to not do that. And I felt like that I'd reached the end. And I'd had an agreement with my brother, who's my business partner and best friend. And we were running the fun fair together. And I used to let him run the fun fair while I went off and did these summer seasons. And he said to me, look, Richard, he said, you've done it. It's time now. You've had your fun. You're not become the next Paul Daniels or the next big one that you dreamt you would be. It's time now you came back and you put your, you know, that we grafted and we do this business that you promised you'd work with me, because you're always running off doing these things. You've had your chance. If you can't better now, if there's no point going back doing the holiday centre, you did that 20 years ago. So he was right. So I said to my brother, I said, well, if I'm coming back, I feel like a failure. So I want to come back, feel like I've done something good. So I'm going to buy a big ride. I said, I want a roller coaster. I said, I've got to come back feeling like I've achieved something otherwise. So we bought this old scrappy roller coaster from Sweden, and we had to buy it really quickly. And the reason why we got it cheap, we had to go to Sweden in the freezing cold winter and take it down quick before they closed this amusement park. So I sold my illusions. I sold them off. And I sold various props to all sorts of people. Danny Hunt bought the Vanishing Motorcycle off me, which was the hardest thing to sell because I had so much history to it. And I went to Sweden and we built this roller coaster, and we were pulling this roller coaster down virtually in the snow. And so that was the end of my illusion career. I was still going to be Love Magic, but I knew I wasn't going to perform again, big stuff in that way. And my agent phoned me up, a guy called Stanley Dallas, and he went, you're sitting down. He said, Matthew Corbett's retiring and they want someone to replace him and you're in the frame. Now, I had never really done kid stuff, but Stanley was an agent that had got a lot of inroads with Granada TV. And they'd said to him, do you know anyone that can replace Matthew Corbett? He went, oh, I've got just the guy. And it was like, what? I said, really? I said, but I'd done the City Show as a kid, as a guest. So I said, but that's the gig. That gig never comes up. That's Matthew Corbett. It's just not a gig that is ever come up. I said, well, you're in the frame. And I went and I just at that moment, and my brother said, if you think for one moment you're going to get out of pulling this roller coaster down and loading it into the lorry and build, so don't think you're running off to do this, you know. So he made me do my, you know, my pound of flesh with that bloody roller coaster. But I remember getting that news in Sweden, and I went for the audition, and I made sure, I mean, here's, I'm not preaching to anyone, but I've learned a few things. Hard work equals luck. And I did not put in some work before I went to that audition. I went to see every stage show Matthew Corbett, covertly, every stage show he did. I went down to Blockbuster and hired every sooty videotape I could watch and watched every episode. I went to the toy shop and I bought all the puppets. I went to my friend Brian Glover, who taught me the magic. I went to Leicester and said, teach me, do a routine. What can I do with this? And I did that the week prior to this audition. So I went in with every feeling as hard, like I could have done no more. So, of course, when they said to me, well, in the stage show, I said, well, I went to see them. And I know it counted for a great deal. So there was a lot of, you know, screen testing. There were other people they looked at as well. It wasn't just me. And after a lot of screen testing, I remember Stanley phoning and saying, he said, you've got it. It's you. And I cried. I just cried and cried and cried. And I remember they said, we're going to send you Sooty to practice with. And it's like something out of a dream. I've told this story before, but it's true. So I was expecting some sort of flight case or, you know, a special delivery or something. Anyway, I remember hearing this shoving sound and watching this jiffy bag being forced through the letterbox door and opening it up, and with a compliment slip, there was Sooty in a jiffy bag. It was the most undignified meeting. But I remember looking at it and thinking, this is crazy. And then the Sooty journey began, and that is a whole nother story. I mean, that's a whole roller coaster, literally, in itself, because that wasn't all easy. You'd think it would be, but it wasn't. But you know, it was a life-changing moment, I mean, completely for me. So when you
started with Sooty, were you, because I know that you own Sooty, you own the brand, you own everything, right?
Yeah.
You didn't own the brand when you first took it. So nope. Would you mind sharing how that came to be and how all of that happened?
Wow. I'll have to make this short. Okay. So I was their presenter. I've been cast as their presenter, and I did 4 series for ITV, and the scripts, they started off okay, and the scripts became terrible. They were rubbish. And because I loved it so much, I'd been fallen in love with Sooty so much, and I'd got all the old Harry Corbett vintage stuff, and I'd done all my research, and I loved it. I felt when they cast me, they gave me the impression they wanted me to have a great input into it, in the way Matthew Corbett used to write everything. Well, they didn't want me to do anything. They just used to give me these scripts, and it was awful. Some of the last stuff we did was terrible. There was no jokes, no slapstick. It was all moralistic and saying sorry to people. And it was just, well, it wasn't the Sooty show. And I remember the head of ITV Children's calling me up and said, look, I want to be the first to tell you, we're not renewing the Sooty TV series. She said, it's nothing to do with you, but I just wanted you to know that we're not going to renew it. Now, when I took the job on, I just thought it would be a gig that lasted forever. So they didn't renew the series because the scripts were so bad. Matthew Corbett, who I was still became friends with, remember him saying to me, he said, if my father could have seen what they did with it, he'd turn in his grave. And I went, well, it was nothing to do with me. And on the internet, you know, it was horrible. There was all these fan sites, even in the early days of the internet. And they were saying, Richard Goodell ruined Sooty. It's rubbish. And it was so, again, I wanted to say, guys, I had no control of this at all. You know, I just had to read the words. And, it was that sort of thing. So what happened was, because it came off the television, the whole brand became stagnant. And the owners of the brand, it changed hands a few times, nothing happened. The owners of the brand decided in 2008 they were going to sell it. Now, I would say, oh, I've done it for 23 years or whatever. Well, actually, I say that publicly. I didn't, because there was this pause, you know, in 2002, whatever. It was press pause. 6 years I didn't do it. I worked on the fairground, basically. Fairground, it was an amusement park. I remember somebody calling me and said, have you seen the back page of The Guardian? It's 2008 now. It said, Sooty is for sale. There's a story about it. It's for sale. They're selling the rights to it. So I remember going into the office with my brother. And by this point, our amusement park was quite big. We had some big rides and it was quite a big operation. And I said to my brother, I said, I don't care what this costs. We have to buy this. It's not about an ego. I said, we've got to put this right. Because I took this so personally. I said, I know how to put this right. And all we have to do is just put it back. It's not going to be hard to fix this. We have to buy it. And we went into sort of this closed bidding war. It was all a bit covert. because they didn't, they sort of knew who I was, but I didn't want them to know it was me that was putting in bids. But several other people were bidding as well, and they'd given a guide price, and I knew what Matthew Corbett had sold it for, and it was close to 2 million. So it was, of course, when he sold it, it was on television, and it was this, and it wasn't that now. So we weren't at that level, but we were certainly, you know, we were certainly up there. So it was serious sort of commitment from us financially. But I just knew, I said to my brother, look, if we can't make this work again, we'll put it to work on the amusement park, and we'll build a little sooty feature, and we'll do a little sooty show, and we'll get some value out of it, because it still means something to a lot of people. It's not on television now, but to a generation, it means we'll get. And he agreed with me, he supported me. And so we got we won the bid. They found out it was me, and they were a bit like, oh God, it was him again, you know. But we won it, we owned the brand. So now we're sat with this brand, which is not on television. It's not touring on stage. There's no toys, it's nothing. So I said to my brother, I said, look, we've got to get it back on the telly. That's the first thing we've got to do. So I went back to ITV, and the head of children's had changed, but she was lovely to me. And she said, well, make a pilot. Go and make a pilot. She said, what are you going to do with it? I said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. So I'm going to put it back to exactly what it was, but when Matthew Corbett was doing it. Sooty Sweep and Sue, pies in the face. We're not going to educate everybody. It's kids come home from school. They want to laugh. We're going to make it funny again. We're not going to change it. We're just going to put it back, but we're going to bring it, you know, it'll be modern, the modern world. And she said, oh, well, what did you know about TV shows? You never made one. Go and make a pilot. So I went and we shot this episode. Now it's on YouTube. It's called The Big Day Out. And it was the first thing that I ever wrote completely for Sooty with a friend of mine. And it's shot at our amusement park by the sea. So we used our own location, and the story is about us going for a day at the amusement park and whatever, going to the sea. So we shot everything on our own locations. And we took it back to the head of ITV. And Michael Vine was my agent then. Michael Vine is Darren Brown's agent and was a formidable producer of television. And he had no intention of getting involved in producing a TV series because he'd got enough to do. But he came with me, and suddenly it gave me a lot of credibility. I went, oh, hang on a minute, is Michael involved in making the TV show? Michael said, well, I'll watch over him and make sure he knows how to make a TV show. So that was a massive tick. And then they watched The Big Day Out. They didn't laugh at anything. It was like a silence for an hour. And I was just looking at Michael and thinking, oh, are they going to like this? What are they thinking? And she just turned at me, this lady at the end, and she just went, could you make 26 episodes? And I went, well, yeah, I could. And she went, but I have to tell you, we don't have fortunes of money to give you to make it. And I want that location. And I realize it must have cost a fortune. And I was just about to go, well, as a matter of fact, and Michael kicked me under the table. He went, yes, it did. So they never realized, and we shot. So if you watch the latest series, or it was always shot at a theme park, and I drew on my experience as a holiday camp entertainer to put the blue coat on, and I play, you know, this guy that's running this entertainment place, a theme park and a holiday camp, and that's why. So all that location, it was mine and my brother's amusement park. So it all fell into place. And of course, once that came on the telly, people wanted to know, hang on, where's this park that's on the telly where Sooty lives? So then hang on, now all of a sudden the park's getting busier. So then we started, of course, the theatre tours came off the back of that, and then the pantomime calls started happening. And so it was just a big risk that we took, but I knew we could do it. It wasn't hard to fix. I mean, it was Sooty.
It's a massive risk. I mean, you paid whatever you paid for a brand that literally kind of had no value in many ways because it wasn't doing anything. I mean,
we were very, very lucky. Do you know what? It was a very lucky situation because I'm sure there were many people, even probably with more talent and creativity than I, that could have given something to that brand. I was in a very unique position because every year me and my brother would commit a chunk of money to buying a new ride. And it would always be a significant thing, like a log flume or a huge something. So that year we didn't. We bought Sooty. So we had a little chunk of money sat there. And we were able also to, because obviously we use asset finance and things for these things, you know, we were able to secure some of the money for Sutty on all the assets we got. It was secured on the roller coaster. You know, if we didn't pay for Sutty, they'd have took the coaster off us. You know, so and we also, I was at that age where we were young. My brother, I didn't have any family. My brother didn't have any family. We were, you know, you take risks when you, whatever. And we would, and I just said, what's the worst that could happen? You know, what's the worst that could happen? So I mean, I look back sometimes and don't know quite how it happened, but thank God it did, because it changed my life, and I've been able to do so many wonderful, wonderful things with it, and meet so many wonderful people. It's been great, yeah.
And it's gone strength from strength to strength, you know, yeah. And continued to go to strength to strength. And you've brought it back, like you said you were going to do. You took it back to its original idea. We spoke off camera beforehand. You've revitalized it. You've made it. You've still kept the core identity. But at the same time, you've kept it, you've made it bang up to date. It's brilliant.
Yeah, we got some belted new stuff coming out. So something happening this Christmas, which is the most elaborate thing. I'm going into watch it being edited tomorrow. Most elaborate thing I've ever done with Sutty. I'll tell you, it's an exclusive. I'll probably get my knuckles wrapped for this, actually, but I won't go into too much detail other to say that there's going to be a Christmas video out with Sutty and sweeping it. I'll have to be cryptic because because there's other people involved, but it's a Christmas video. It only lasts 2 minutes 20 seconds, this video, but it's a very special thing for a great cause, and it's the most elaborate thing I've ever shot with Sutty. I mean, movie style production, which we did a few weeks back, and I'm going to see it cut together tomorrow. And it's a Christmas themed thing. So we had snow and rain, real reindeers and Santa and a sleigh and 70 children. And oh my goodness. So it was wonderful. Anyway, so that's a big clue. Watch out for it.
I'll be watching that. That's amazing. And like I say, it does go from strength to strength. It continues to just be a hugely dominant force that's watched by, you know, so many kids and so many adults, if we're honest as well. I mean, it's just brilliant. I'm going to ask you a question. Do you ever find sometimes, because you said to me, you know, you're a performer, you were born to do this, and you love performing on the illusions and before, and then you've kind of gone to spend the last 10, 15 years, 20 years associated with Sutty. Do you ever find that you've lost your own identity as a performer a little bit, and it's no longer, you know, like Richard Cadell, illusionist, it's now Richard Cadell and Sutty? And is that an issue or is that not an issue?
I love doing the Sutty stuff. I love it. But yes, I always feel, I'm very respectful of it's Harry Corbett's creation. Harry will always be Sutty's dad. Matthew will always be, you know, a good friend of Sutty's. That's what, in Harry's own words, he actually said, Matthew was a good friend. I'm his father. I mean, Harry. So Harry Corbett will always be Sutty's dad. So I do feel, in a way, I'm just the guardian of someone else's act, and hopefully somebody will carry it on when I do it. So, which is why here we go. So, I'm starting to do the big pantomimes as a result of Sutty. And me and my brother decided in 2014, we would sell our amusement park. He was going to emigrate, and we were 50-50. He was going to emigrate, and I was going to just focus on doing the Sutty show and do more of that. And I said to myself, I said, right, when we sell that park, I'm going to treat myself. I'm going to buy a Mercedes SL500 AMG supercar. You know, I've always wanted one. And it was ridiculous. Anyway, I test drove, we sold the amusement park, and I test drove this car. It was a ridiculous amount of money. I mean, obscene and an embarrassing amount of money. And I got out of the car and I thought, what the hell was that all about? I'm not going to buy a car. It's just a car. What was I dreaming all these years? I thought, but I need to treat myself. I built this business up. And I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll buy an illusion. And when they phone me for the pantomime this year, I'm going to say, well, I'm going to do the Sutty business, but I want to do an illusion where it's no Sutty. I just want to be me. You know, and I thought, this is my treat. This is my gift to myself for selling the business that we built up over 20, 30 years. And the one illusion I always wanted to do, which I could never afford, was Franz Ferrari's slicer. You know, you flip the girl and stretch it out. And I nobody was building them over here. So I phoned Illusion Projects over in Las Vegas, which I didn't realize who that was. And I was on the phone to, and I'll tell you, here's a lovely story. So I'm on the phone to, I phoned up Illusion Projects because somebody said, oh, they can build you on Illusion Projects. And a lady answered the phone and said, hi, can you build me a slicer? You know, France-right slice. And she said, I'm sorry, we don't really have any time at the minute to build one-off illusions for magicians. We've sort of stopped doing that. We tend to build, you know, the big shows. We do Copperfields. We do, you know, we tend to build shows in their entirety rather than one-offs. But if ever we get a gap in the production line, we could fit it in. I said, well, here's my name. She went, I said, call me if you get a name. It's Richard Cadell. And she went, hang on a minute. She said, we already make for you. I said, I've never bought anything off you. I could never afford to. So I haven't bought an illusion for 20 years. I said, I've not bought anything off you. She went, you have, you're on our system, Richard Cadell. And she went, hang on, I'll put you through. And it's Tim Clothier on the phone. And he went, Richard, I went, Tim, what are you doing out there? I taught Tim Clothier. I taught him every week his magic act that went on to win Young Magician of the Year. I taught him that. He had lessons with me for weeks and weeks and weeks because he lived in Taunton, which is about 30 minutes down the road from me. So he went, I hadn't spoken to him for 20 years. And it was his business. And he went, I said, what are you doing there? He said, well, this is my business. He said, of course I'll build you a slicer. I said, what's all that Richard Cadell business? And this, I say this with great humility. He said, well, when we build stuff for Copperfield, he said, it's under strict confidentiality. And even the people that work for us are not allowed to know what they're building and, more importantly, who it's for. So he said, the code name for a Copperfield order is Richard Cadell. He said, and that's because you taught me. And I had a little moment at that. I had a moment about that, and that's probably the biggest compliment anyone's ever paid me. And he said, so you're really going to mess the order system up now. We're going to have Richard Cadell too now. So anyway, so he built me this slicer. So I announced to the pantomime company I was going to do the slicer, and as soon as it arrived, it was so beautiful, and it was, oh, it's such a beautiful, beautiful thing. And then I was, that was it then, I went mad. I said, right, okay, I want a bump in the night, I want this and all that. And then suddenly I've got this big illusion act, and I'm doing these in the pantomimes now, I have my own illusion spot. And then as a result of that, a guy came to see me in the pantomime and said, I'd love to do a magic show with, you know, I've seen The Illusionists and I've seen this, I'd love to do it. And would you do The Illusions? And I just thought, well, yeah, you know, I'm getting on a bit, what an opportunity. And I said, well, as long as the get-ins and get-outs are easy and, you know, as long as it's, let's make it easy because these are big things to move. Get that bit right and I'm on board. And hence this is this ridiculous extreme magic thing where I get to play at being the illusionist I always dreamed that I would be with the equipment that I always dreamed I'd have and could never remotely come close to when I was trying to really make it. I couldn't have the wonderful toys that I've got now. I mean, and it is just, it's pure passion, it's pure indulgence now. I just adore doing it. I mean, I don't.
Isn't it crazy that you told a story that, like, many, many years ago, you thought, you know, when the theatres ended, you know what, I'm done. I'm going to go and do this. I you sold all your illusions. Yeah. You know, now all these years later, wow! If you could go back and speak to young Richard back then and say, this is what I'm going to be doing in 20 odd years' time.
Well, if I'd have seen all those props that I've got now, I wouldn't have dreamed I'd have ever got them. Nice little. Sorry, I'm being indulgent doing all the talking. But just again, another lovely circle that came round when I was putting this together, this for Extreme Magic. I mean, I had enough good props that I could do a spot in pantomime, but I know I needed more things. So I went to see Danny Hunt and I went, have you still got the bike, Vanish? This is 20 years on. And he went, yeah. I said, could I borrow it? And he went, well, why don't you buy it? I went, yeah, I'd love to. So he sold it to me for exactly the same price I sold it to him to 20 years before. And the bike Vanish is, and it is closing the show. My prop, the same prop that Dave Shaw built for me all those years ago on credits, exactly the same prop. And I'll tell you, I'll probably get a bit emotional now, but we did Extreme Magic once so far. We did a trial show in Liverpool just after COVID to see if it would work and for James, the producer, to take some video of the thing to put a trailer together to see if he could sell a tour. and I did the motorcycle vanish again. I'd refined it. I'd changed some, it was the prop. I'd changed some subtleties to it. And I think when magicians see it, they'll love one little element of it, because I've spent 20 years thinking about it, thinking if ever I did it again, I'd do that, because I never thought I would. So they'll love one little bit. I'd love to tell you, but I won't spoil it. But the nice thing was, is that Dave Shaw died last year, probably more than a year ago now, actually. And he always viewed that as his finest hour, that trick. And his, as an illusion builder. And I went to see him in his bed. And he died several days after I went to see him. And he was very upbeat when I came. And I said, look, Dave, I showed him the video. I said, look, I'm doing it again. Here it is. He was so proud. He was so pleased. And whenever I do it now, I just think of him and the journey that we had together building it. And you know, that man, he let me owe him money on that thing for years because I hadn't got the money to pay him and stuff back then. But yeah, it's lovely to think that I'm doing it again. And do you know what? It closes the show. And after all these years and all that expensive stuff from Tim and all those wonderful props I have, nothing beats the motorcycle vanish. Nothing. Not for a lay audience, nothing. So there you go. That's a little vignette. Awesome.
That's amazing. And I want to talk about the show, and then I've got one other question, but let's talk about the show because you're touring in October. And I'm going to put a link down below where people can look at the different tour dates and they can look at where to get tickets. But it's an incredible lineup. Like, it's a really, really incredible show.
It is, and I've got to, I'm not begging people to come and see it, but I'm telling you now, it will never happen again at this level. I mean, there's been some great magic shows touring. I'm not knocking them, and a lot of my pals are in them. But James Schoen, the producer, is a magic nut. He soaks it up. He goes to Vegas and watches everyone and loves it. And I'll tell you now, this makes no financial sense. That lineup that he's got is brilliant, but he's touring lighting and plasma screens and six flamethrowers and pyrotechnics of the scale. There are six dancers, there are fire eaters, there's all that stuff that isn't on the poster. And he's doing this. We know it makes no financial sense at all for him. It's one of those shows that will never happen again. It won't happen again because it just, he's doing this purely to do a really great magic show. This is not about numbers, but at the same time, I really want to see people come and support it because he deserves to at least not lose quite as much as he's probably going to lose. He doesn't mind. He just wanted to be brilliant. He'll phone me up. Oh, I've gone and bought this. Oh, James, you know, how many more flames do we need? You know, I mean, you know, what about if we do this? Well, how much is that going to cost you? So I'm very honoured to be. I mean, I'm just one of the acts in it. I'm not producing it or anything. It's his show. But when I just know what he's wrapping around it in terms of production value, and it just. I hope people see it because it's going to be one of those things that people talk about. And we're not going to tour it again. It won't. It just won't. It won't happen again. This is it. We'll do it for October. And I might not probably ever have my chance to showcase all these big props again because I'm doing stuff like the Jaws of Death and, you know, and I've got a beautiful Impaled, a slightly different, the little thing I'm doing slightly different with that, which is nice, but I'll never do that in a panto. They're not going to put buttons on a sword and impale me, or, you know, that's not going to happen. So I don't know when I'll ever do this stuff ever again. So for me, I sort of, you know, it's a bit of a, you know, it's a very special tour for me. But yeah, you're right. It's a belting lineup.
Oh, that's incredible. And I've got my tickets. I'm going to be coming and seeing it. I'm so excited. I'm really, please, really excited.
Please, there's some lovely stuff in there, some nice stuff.
And then, and obviously, you know, for the people that don't know who's in the show, you've got John Archer, who, yeah, my money is one of the funniest men in magic, you know. Yeah. Brilliant. You've got Richard Jones, the only person to win Britain's Got Talent.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's just wow.
Yeah, and some continental acts. James has found two guys that haven't been seen really in the UK before, Arcadio and I can't pronounce her name. She does a quick change and some other stuff. So they're flying in for that. And then when we do Wimbledon, Pete Furman swaps out with John for that. So Pete's brilliant. So anyone coming to Wimbledon will get the chance to see Pete. So, but it's all kind of very fast, very edgy. Everything's bang, bang, bang. No one's on for very long. It's 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes. It moves like light. You know, that's what he wants. There's no indulgence. It's everything moves like, you know, like a rocket. You know, that's how he wants it. It's great. No sort of comparing and welcome. It's just bang, 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 you know, which is lovely. It's lovely. We're talking, I remember, I'm terrible for gassing. What a gas bag. Just before, I'll let you into a little secret. Just before we started talking, we were just about to go live, and Russ Stevens phones you. Yeah. Who I happened to have a lunch with yesterday in Blackpool. Now, back in the day, Russ's show, Mystique, if anyone saw that show, when Mystique was at its prime, and
Nothing else like it.
It was, everybody wanted to be Russ. I mean, and to be in that show. I mean, it was at that time. It was because it moved. There was no gaps. There was no airtime. It just moved. So all I can say with Extreme is that it has that kind of bang to it. You know, I mean, we were reminiscing, and I was talking about Mystique yesterday, and it all came back. What a great. Great Magic and Illusion show that was, and so hopefully we'll channel a bit of that into Extreme.
That's amazing. So here's one more question for you. One more question. I mean, let's be honest, you have achieved so much in your career, both in and outside of magic. You know, you built a huge business that you then sold and did remarkably well from. I mean, that's just outside of magic, but you've performed at an incredibly high level from a very young age. You've achieved success after success after success. Is there anything left? I mean, you've even, and I'm genuinely serious about this, if you took one small subsection of your career and said to the majority of magicians, if you could achieve that at the end of your career, would you be happy? They go, yeah. And you're not at the end of your career, to be clear, and yet you've achieved that and so much more. And now you're back doing the illusions, which you've always wanted to do, and doing a touring show. Like, what's left? I mean, you're done, right? There can't be anything left on your magical bucket list.
Do you know what? I'm at this wonderful point now where probably it's not by design. There probably isn't. I'm just, Phil Hitchcock's a pal. I mean, you know, I think Phil's a brilliant, brilliant performer. Really good and great. Great mind. And we were talking because, again, we've all grown up together, we're all the same age. And he said, he coined it. He said, do you know what? He said, we just enjoy it now, don't we? So we've got nothing to prove anymore. Just enjoy it. And you know what? I go out now and I think, well, I don't have anything else. I've been so lucky. I have done everything I'd love to do. So now I just enjoy it. I don't get nervous and I get excited now about it. I don't get nervous. I just soak it up. So I don't think there's, I don't know. I'm not sure there is anything. I mean, I'll share this with you. I mean, this is a personal thing, but you know, it might come as a surprise to people that know me, but the biggest thing that's happening to me in my life right now, and it's the perfect time because you rightly said, I've had a wonderful, happy life, exploiting all the things I love and even the Funfair business. You know, you say you built a business. Well, I built it on, I loved that business. I absolutely adored it. You know, I got a buzz out of it and I'm still dabbling in it now, I have to tell you. You know, I mean, can't keep away from it. So I've only ever done things that I love, but there is a point in my life now where there is a big change happening, and I'll share this with you, and it's probably the most magical thing ever. I'm having children.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's a long, tricky journey, but we're well on the way. So I'll have a baby definitely within, yeah. So there'll be a time when I can't quite do so much, but the thought of doing that now, that for me now is my to be able to do that. And I think, you know, that's the biggest thing for me right now, is focusing on starting a family at my age. So that's a bit of news, isn't it, eh?
You know, the best thing I ever did was become a dad, genuinely, you know.
Well, and look what you've done. You've created another magician, you know, genuinely. Right, yeah. Brilliant too. You must be very proud, you know.
Really,
I know Matthew Corbett told me he couldn't stand sooty. He got sick of it. He said his earliest memory was his dad shoving the thing over his cock. You know, and it's like, oh, dad, no, we don't want him at the party again. I hope my kids don't, you know, sort of, oh, not again, dad. No, don't, not again. Please, not that. But that's the dream at the minute anyway. So well, I mean, obviously it's not here yet. So, there's all of that to go through. So, you know, there's a bit of luck we need as well, but it looks very, well, it's happening. So
congratulations.
Thank you very much.
That's amazing. That's wonderful news. And I want to, before we wrap it up, let me ask you one more question. One thing that's come across in this interview is your love of sooty and your love of the history and, you know, your desire to bring it back to where it is now. And you mentioned earlier on in the interview, hey, hopefully somebody else will take over at some point down the road. As somebody who is obviously so passionate about this brand and has put so much time and effort into it, is there, I don't want to call it an exit strategy, but is there a plan to continue sooty at some point down the line, or is it just a case of you'll cross that bridge when you come to it?
Well, I think if I'm really honest, you know, sooty, I won't be able to you know, do my illusions forever, even if I had a vehicle to do them, because there comes a point when you might look a bit, not, you know, a bit older, a bit whatever, to do that stuff. Whereas sooty, the precedent's been set with Harry and Matthew. So I know I can carry on performing. I love performing. I love pantomime. So I think I'd carry on. I'd hate to retire. I don't want to, you know, it's a vehicle for me to be able to play all those silly parts and do that stuff. But there is a bit of a thought process happening. We made another series for ITV that will kick out next year, which is a different format. And it's we're trying something a bit different. I'm pleased with it. And hopefully that might pave the way for a time when maybe I don't always do it. Because my mission is to make sure this little bear lives on. And I think I'm sort of almost proof that you can't, if I was to find somebody to present it and hire them, you've got to own it. You've got to be the guy that owns it to present it. I don't think it would work for me to hire someone, because then they might, I don't know, you're risking your whole brand on someone you don't know, and there's an agent negotiating and something they don't want to do it, and all of that stuff. So really, I think either someone's got to buy the whole thing and love it and do it, or there's got to be a way it can operate without me, or not particularly with any one person. But we're a long way off that. Because I have no intentions of stopping it. I'm going to grow old as I have a deal with my partner, and they're going to tell me when they're going to say, "Rich, now's the time." You know, this is when you pass it. But I have no intentions of that being anytime soon. So I'll carry on with the little fella. Yeah.
That's amazing. Richard, this has been an incredible interview. It really has. You've had such an interesting, eclectic life, and you've done so much and gone in so many different directions. If you could give one, let's wrap this interview up, if you could give one piece of advice, because this is watched by magicians all over the UK, as somebody who has achieved so much success, if you could give one piece of advice to people out there that are starting to carve a career for themselves now, and would like to achieve success in this industry,
on a professional level. I'll try and make it as short as possible. All I can say is that just be nice. Just respect the fact you're in a business that everybody is in the business. Everyone in this business is in there basically because they love it. They love it. So respect that. I was never jealous of other magicians because they love magic like I did. I could never understand why people got, you know, be nice, because when people employ people, be a team player. you know, because I know in the pantomime company I work for, there's some very talented people, far better than I am, comedian-wise and all that stuff, that they don't employ because they're not team players. They might be brilliant, but they're not team players. And it's just important to just remember to sometimes don't be the diva. Don't just remember it's important to enjoy what you do and just listen to people and or try and see things from both sides. But if you've I've seen confrontational people, you know, there's a difference between fight, you know, you've got to stand your ground if you want something to be perfect, when people want something to be just right and they know what they're talking about. That's one thing. But just, I would say, just if you want to be successful, you've got to be liked. I'm not saying you've got to act, but you've got to remember that people have got to want to be around you to employ you and give you those opportunities. So, and if you love what you do, that comes naturally anyway. But so just, yeah. That sounds a bit preachy, doesn't it?
Oh, it doesn't. It reminds me of that Wayne Dobson line. It's nice to be important, but it's more important to be nice.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit lame, I suppose, in some ways. But, I know I've got gigs sometimes, not because I've been the best, but because I've been prepared to just, you know, muck in and do as directed and whatever, you know. So
that's amazing. Amazing advice. And I want everyone watching this to go and support you. So I'm going to put the tour dates down below. Like you said, this might not never happen again. So it's now is the time, right?
Yeah.
Now is the time to go and check it. You're literally touring all over the UK. So places that people
but there's plenty of opportunity to go. Please, yeah, I'd love people to come and support it, just because it would be lovely. And we're going to do a little meet and greet thing afterwards and all that stuff. It'd be lovely. It'd just be nice. And if you don't get a chance to say hello, I'm always at Blackpool Convention. Never miss it, ever. Cancel everything about that. So, you know, always, you know, anyone ever wanted to talk to me or ask me anything, if they think I can, you know, just come up to me. And if you don't get a chance to, you know, if you want to see the show and don't get a chance to say hello, come and, you know, talk to me. Be nice. I like that. That's what it's all about. When I go to Blackpool, I see very few of the lectures and things. I just like, that's what it's all about, isn't it? Just talking
about
what we love. Yeah, what we love. Exactly. Yeah.
And where can people see you at Panto this year? You've mentioned Panto a few times. Where are you going to be?
I'm going back to Southampton. I did it last year. And I'm going back to the Mayflower in Southampton. Jason Donovan is the star. And I'm doing, because I did my Illusions last year, I'm doing more Illusions this year. So I get to do, I'm doing the motorcycle vanish in the pantomime this year, among other things. Super looking forward to doing that in the Panto. So yeah, Mayflower Theatre, Southampton. It's Goldilocks and the circus acts in it as well. So, and I'm Joey the Clown.
So. Nice. That's awesome. That's brilliant. Well, you know what? Congratulations on all of your success. Congratulations on everything you're achieving. And more importantly, congratulations on being a dad. That is brilliant.
Well, not yet, but it's like,
getting there.
Counting down. That's well, yeah, you'll see me pushing the chair around the convention. Yeah, hopefully.
That's brilliant. All right. Richard, thank you so much for the interview. I really appreciate it. I want everyone to leave a comment down below. So let Richard know what you thought. Leave a comment down below and go check out the description link. There's going to be a link to where you can go get tickets. It's going to have all of the tour dates. I'm also going to put a link down there for the Mayflower so you can check out the pantomime. Go have a look at all of that information and let's support the show, because I know I'm going and it's going to be brilliant.
Thank you so much. Richard,
thank you so much, my friend. I'll see you again soon.
Take care. Bye now.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic.
Be sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel.
Magic TV.
Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV. Or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.